From WGCU, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Hundreds of human beings are trafficked in Florida every year, and of those reported, the vast majority involve young women trafficked for sex. Now, a new report shows that many of these victims are used for sex tourism in South Florida. Traffickers bring victims to Florida to meet the demand of Florida's wintertime tourists. The report also shows that LGBT young people are being trafficked to tourists as well. Ahead, a conversation with the leaders in Florida's fight against this modern form of slavery. Also today, the Marty Stokes Band from Sanibel Island will represent our region at the 33rd International Blues Challenge. Mr. Stokes joins us in the studio to talk about the genre, his band, and he's bringing along a guitar, so we may get an impromptu acoustic session. First, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. A band from Sanibel is heading to the 33rd Annual International Blues Challenge in Tennessee. In the second half of our show, we talk with the frontman from the Marty Stokes Band and listen to a few tunes that are sending them to perform in Memphis. But first, human trafficking victimizes hundreds of women and men every year in Florida. The majority of the victims are women, and most victims are trafficked for sex. On paper, the report for 2016 paints a grim picture, with the number of reports of human trafficking doubling in the last year. But behind those numbers is a difficult truth. It can be incredibly hard to correctly identify a victim of human trafficking, and the modern form of slavery is defined by its broad connection with other areas of crime, drugs, prostitution, abuse, and more. Joining us to talk about Florida's efforts to combat human trafficking and to describe how it plays into the sex tourism industry in South Florida is Bethany Gillot with the Department of Juvenile Justice. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Also joining the program to discuss their work helping victims of sex trafficking are Lowell and Sally Sennetz with the Wings of Shelter International. It's a shelter for victims that's located in Southwest Florida. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Human trafficking and sex tourism in Southwest Florida. That's our topic today on Gulf Coast Live. Have you seen or suspected sex tourism in your area? Call in and share your experiences at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we are at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Bethany, when we look at the 2016 report on human trafficking in Florida, there's not a lot in the report about, well, there is a lot in the report about what is not known. So why is that?
As with drug trafficking, arms trafficking, any form of underground kind of industry or illegal industry, there is a lot that we don't know because there's just a lot that we can't see. We've come a long way in the state of Florida in terms of being better able to see, making sure that our Department of Juvenile Justice staff, Department of Children and Family staff, law enforcement, service providers, anybody that may come across at-risk youth or adults are able to see now, are able to identify what those risk factors are. But it's still a pretty underground thing. And like this, working in the anti-trafficking field is my full-time job. Traffickers' full-time job is to try to recruit youth to become into victimization. But it's also to try to keep off the radar, keep from being caught by law enforcement. So it's just something that is going to continuously be an effort where they're trying to stay, traffickers are trying to stay one step ahead of all of us to ensure that they have a never-ending ability to commit these horrendous offenses.
So you have to go mainly on reports of suspected trafficking and then follow it up from there?
Yeah, so a lot of the data that we're getting are kids that we're identifying once they hit a system. So DJJ has our, the Department of Juvenile Justice has our identification efforts, and DCF has their identification efforts as well. But, of course, these are kids who have hit our system. So a lot of the numbers that we are seeing, or all of the numbers that we're seeing at this time from our two agencies, are showing kids that have actually been identified by a system and aren't reflective of kids, of course, that have not been identified through one of our two systems or alternative systems, such as one of our runaway homeless youth shelters, our prevention, our service providers, such as Wings of Shelter.
So you mentioned your organization, the Department of Juvenile Justice, and then also DCF. Are there any other agencies that are involved in tracking this problem?
A lot of our agencies, so there's quite a few agencies that sit on the Statewide Council on Human Trafficking. There's also Department of Health. Department of Education has a lot of efforts that they're doing right now to try to ensure that their staff are trained so they can start seeing what this issue looks like amongst their population. So there's a lot of different law enforcement at the table. I know entities such as the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office, for example, they have an entirely in-house unit for just investigating and prosecuting human trafficking cases, so they have some tracking efforts. There are definitely some tracking efforts going on, but at a statewide level, DCF and GJJ are the two primary entities right now collecting data on minors that are being exploited in both labor and sex trafficking.
And then you're able to understand one another's numbers through this council? I mean, cross-communication?
DCF and GJJ actually have a data-sharing agreement, so we're constantly looking at each other's data. And then because both of our Secretary Daley with GJJ and Secretary Carroll with DCF both sit on the Statewide Council and chair the Services and Resources Committee underneath that council, so there's constant conversation between our two entities and the entities on the council about all of our efforts that we're doing and about all of the efforts that many of our other state agencies members of our legislature are doing to tackle this issue.
It's kind of interesting. It seems like it was kind of a scattered thing to pay attention to, and now a lot of larger organizations are paying closer attention to it and trying to get as much information as you can. But as you mentioned, it's hard to get that information. So based on what information you were able to get, what does this 2016 report tell us about the problem in Florida?
The main thing that the 2016 report is telling us is that we're doing a lot better job identifying this population. So we have seen a big increase. The news article came out that there's been a 50% increase in human trafficking victims in the state of Florida. What that's really showing us is that we are doing a better effort at identifying this population. So I think that's one of the biggest things. While we do have a lack of numbers still, and we still have, it is difficult to collect data on this population. The consistent growth and identification, we had 576 unique youths between March 2015 and 2016 that had calls accepted by the hotline for further investigation. That's just DJJ kids, and we have never had a number like that prior to our targeted identification efforts.
I guess it's awareness and education. Did you say 50 or 15%?
50%. There was a new article that came out recently noting that that there was a little over 50% increase in human trafficking victimization in the state of Florida. But it's actually a very good representation of how much better we're doing at identifying this population.
So, I mean, the actual events of human trafficking may not have actually jumped by 50%. It's just that you're picking it up more and you're understanding and being able to identify it better.
Exactly.
So Lowell and Sally Senetz, you work with these victims at Wings of Shelter International here in Southwest Florida. Tell us, who are these victims that we're talking about? Who are these?
Well, we're specializing in female minors, and we also run across a lot of male population that really virtually don't have services availing to them. Other than large shelters, there are less and few specific shelters like ours, which is a long-term rehabilitation shelter. And so we do not take 20, 30 kids at a time. We take a selective few, and we do it in a family-style model so that they get their mental health needs, their educational needs, their tutoring, and their social, psychosocial needs met. The difficult thing about the girls we see is they're highly exploited from very young ages. So they've grown into 11, 12, 13, 14, and they may have been exploited since they were 8, 10 years old, even earlier in some cases that we've found. Also, I think identification is one of the main difficult things, as these children are not kidnapped as much as they used to be, where they'd be on a missing poster. They're actually left to live at their homes and or in maybe in a foster care home, and they're lured out, and then they're coerced, And then they become fearful to not cooperate with the trafficker because they're threatened. In some cases, they're beaten. And sometimes it's a boyfriend type of approach where they're lured and coerced into child sex trafficking.
Because when we hear about when the general public hears about child sex trafficking, you think of somebody that's been kidnapped or somebody who doesn't speak English, that just came here from another country and doesn't understand the system here and is fearful of being deported or something. Mm-hmm. But you're telling me these are American girls.
These are American females. And yes, they live throughout the state of Florida. We're servicing female victims under the age of 18. So we say the level of trauma that they're experiencing is akin to a victim of war. If you think of a young girl, say 11, 12, 14 years old, being exploited five times a night by males, five times a week for 5 years, they will have literally been raped 6,500 times. This is a very high level of stress disorder. So they all come away with post-traumatic stress disorder. And they are primed and cued and trained to run right back to the trafficker when offered safe haven. So that's one of the difficulties that we do face, is keeping them in location, in a safe location, where they can receive services.
I wanted to add that the first three girls that we got into our shelter were Lee County residents living at home, going to school, being forced to have sex after school on weekends and during the summer. So that was our first exposure, and it did shock us because, like most people, we thought that they were abducted from bus stops, which happens, of course, but it's very prevalent now that it's financially to the benefit of the trafficker to let them live at home and be fed. Now, of course, there are some that are kidnapped and taken on circuits. So, I mean, anything you could think of and they do to exploit the girls.
So as a parent, I'm sitting here hearing this, and I'm wondering where – how do the parents not know this? How does this not become evident at the home?
Well, I would like to answer that because one of the stories that I tell are based on a lot of our girls' history. They might be at a shopping center, three girls at the shopping center, 11, 15, and 16. The trafficker may pay a recruiter, a younger man, really cute guy, not the big hairy guy, the cute guy, to go along the shopping center and spot the three girls and identify which girl he will hit on to become in his trafficking ring. And that man will walk up behind them and maybe walk along beside. He'll study which one looks the more innocent. He'll come up to her and say, "How beautiful you look." I couldn't help but noticing I had to come over and say something. "I also noticed that your two girlfriends kind of ignore you and are kind of snobby. If I were with you, I wouldn't take my eyes off of you." So right away, he psychologically starts to divide the bonding between the three girls. He might say, "Come on over. I'll buy you some ice cream right out here in the open. No harm, no foul." Within 10 minutes, he knows where she lives. He knows her name. He knows where she goes to school. He knows if there's a father in the home or she has a single mom or sisters, brothers. And within 10 minutes, he's identified her to be his next victim to get his payment from the trafficker in the background when he turns her over. And this pursuit or this grooming effort may go on for several weeks or months.
Before he turns her over.
Before he turns her over.
And if I may say, a lot of there's a great deal of exploitation that could happen entirely within a child's home, such as web-based exploitation that could get increasingly, the trafficker is becoming increasingly more demanding, and a youth may literally feel trapped in their own home, and they may feel like some of this is their fault because they chose to interact with this person on social media that they weren't familiar with, and so there may be some guilt and shame involved with that, and so they just may feel like they can't even talk to their parents, and that type of exploitation could be happening within the home. But traffickers are really savvy to try to stay one step ahead. If they think that there's going to be eyes on that youth, then they're going to hesitate to potentially recruit that youth in particular, or they're going to work around those supervision options. They'll talk to these kids in that grooming boyfriend phase to learn when parents are home, to learn how much supervision there is at the home, to learn whether or not that school is going to notice that child is absent. So they're going to make sure that they're understanding the details around that individual child's life to know how they can best exploit that child.
One of the words you used that I found interesting, both the boyfriend phase, mm-hmm. where they pretend to be the boyfriend and give this young girl who people always want – everybody wants to think they're cute, and everybody wants to think someone thinks they're the best-looking one in the mall or whatever, and just give them that attention and then be able to prey upon them, especially teenage.
Absolutely.
Those years are tough. Yeah.
Absolutely. We'll and I know in the state of Georgia, excuse me, they passed a law where children could not roam the mall under the age of 18 without an adult with them. And their trafficking percentage went down 35% after that law was passed. Really? So having your daughters roam around the mall on their own with a couple of friends is no longer a safe thing to do. There needs to be an adult supervision with them.
It's not uncommon for us to get a girl, let's say 11 years old, and when she first comes to us, she identifies that she has a boyfriend who happens to be 42 years old, and she really thinks that this man who's been exploiting her, selling her to other men, really loves her. We used to call it Stockholm syndrome. Now we call it trauma bonding, and that is a very strong, powerful thing, very hard to break. And that's what we do. That's our purpose in rehabilitating, is to get the girls to go from being a victim to a survivor, and then eventually an overcomer.
It's staggering that this is happening, because I remember walking around in the mall when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, is there more of human trafficking happening now than back then? And how can that have risen?
I think what's happened is the people that were drug gangs and selling drugs and firearms have discovered that it's very profitable. You can sell a drug once and a firearm once, but if you sell a girl, you can sell her over and over many, many times for years. So it's very profitable crime business today. And it isn't that they don't also sell drugs and firearms as well, but now they've caught on to the idea of the profitability, and it's a money-driven crime. And so it's all about the profit and the money they can make. The difference between molestation and sex trafficking is molestation is all about power, but sex trafficking is all about money. The end point is to gain money for yourself.
Bethany, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I think that Sally is entirely correct, and I think it's also societally we're looking at this so much differently now. 20 years ago, it was just child prostitution. These were just bad kids that ran away from home. It was a much more look at the child as a criminal as opposed to look at the child as a victim.
Yeah, that's an interesting change.
A lot of that Florida law has changed a lot of that. So now everybody's understanding that these aren't just bad kids, child prostitutes, but that there's no child that would willingly choose to be involved in such a dangerous environment. And so I think it's just as much societally changing.
We are talking about human trafficking and sex tourism in South Florida. That's our topic today on Gulf Coast Live. If you have seen or suspected sex tourism in your area, give us a call and share your thoughts. 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And on Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. And I wanted to talk about the sex tourism idea. There's sex trafficking and then sex tourism. Bethany, can you tell me the difference between this?
So with our minors, under federal and Florida law, there wouldn't be a difference, because sex tourism would also involve that commercial sex element that would make our minors a victim. If there's an adult that is willingly involved in the commercial sex industry, then that's where your nuanced difference between sex tourism and sex trafficking may come in. However, a lot of sex tourism would be the demand side of our sex trafficking. So Florida, being a tourist destination for all sorts of things, around big event times or during the winter, we see a large increase in kids being trafficked down to the state of Florida from northern states. I used to work directly with this population. I see a lot of girls from Wisconsin, Minnesota, New York being trafficked down to Florida during the winter months, because it is much warmer down here, of course, but also because that is our high tourism season in Southeast and Southwest Florida is the winter months. It's December through March when our weather is just absolutely beautiful. So that increased amount of tourism, some of which would be specific for sex tourism, people coming down specifically for the purposes of participating in commercial sex act, that would fuel that need to bring down additional survivors that would be forced and exploited in our area during that time. So there is a lot of tie-in with some distinction, but it's certainly part of that demand aspect that fuels trafficking.
Are you seeing an increase with the numbers that you're able to gather in sex tourism in Florida? Like people coming here for that purpose? I mean, you said that they're bringing girls down here to meet the needs because of the increase in population in this area. But are you seeing people, more people coming here specifically for that, or are you able to track that?
I think that would be a law enforcement question. I wouldn't, for the kids that we're identifying as potential trafficking victims, we wouldn't necessarily know the purpose, who is the person that is creating the demand in that situation, who's the customer in that scenario. I wouldn't know the specifics on them or whether they're from the state of Florida, whether they came down for sex. Law enforcement may be able or might be tracking trends on that.
So Lowell and Sally, have you helped any victims that have been involved in like a sex tourism type of a thing?
Absolutely. All of the girls that we get have been utilized for patrons in hotels. That's one of the large money-making industry arenas. And the way that that works is when people travel and they have the wealth, they travel to warm weather states like Florida and California. California is one of the largest states in the nation with child trafficking. Florida might be three or four, and it teeters back and forth. But you follow the warmth, you follow the luxury, and you follow the money. And therefore, the traffickers know that, you know, when the tourist seasons are in each of these states, and they follow that as well. So even during a Super Bowl held somewhere, they might bring in thousands and thousands of young girls from all the United States right into the Super Bowl arena area, and they start selling like crazy. People, when they go on vacations, they kind of take on a falsetto of bravery in that they'll do things they might not have done at home in their own territory. And I think we've, not in the terms of crime business, but we've all experienced being braver when we're out of the country than we are when we're in our own little nest. And so I think that's part of it. And also the tourists don't realize, the end user, or we call the John, doesn't realize that these girls are necessarily being criminalized. They think of them as voting to do this, that they're doing this to make money, but they don't see them as a victim and that they're being controlled by a trafficking gang. They're not operating alone. That's not going to happen.
You also mentioned something about, you know, foreign versus domestic. And the State Department has come up with some stats, and they say about 18,000 men, women, and children are trafficked into the United States each and every year. And you contrast that with statistics just for girls between the ages of 11 and 17. It's about 100,000 to 300,000 are at risk each and every year. The FBI actually, I saw an estimate of 296,000, they believe. Yes. And, you know, that doesn't include boys. It doesn't include men and women. That's just teenage girls. So you can see this is really a domestic problem.
You don't think about this as a person who's not involved in it. So you hear this and it's just kind of shocking. And then you start hearing about the LGBT youth who are being trafficked, which is just now. Bethany, you said this is kind of a new area. What's happening with that?
Well, that's heartbreaking, I think, because the LGBT youth have a special stigma in our culture. And therefore, they're fighting that stigma, but they are very vulnerable to being sex trafficked. And they don't want to reveal it. They don't want to report it because they feel that they will get the same kind of attitude that they get in their lifestyle, and that is a push away, you're so bad attitude. So I think that we're just now waking up to that arena that needs servicing and needs to help with rehabilitation. And there's a couple of gentlemen up north, up in the Tampa area, that now is just opening safe houses for that use explicitly. But I think whether you're whatever your sexual orientation is, you're going to become so coerced and so ashamed and fearful that you're not going to self-report. That's what makes this crime such a hidden crime, is that people, young children, do not self-report because of the reactions they get. I always say, a little girl, if she's your granddaughter, your neighbor, your niece, she wakes up one day when she's 14. No child wakes up and says, I want to be a prostitute today. That just doesn't happen. So there's a lot of coercion and a lot of force that's included in that.
Well, and what the kids don't self-report. So how are people able to identify adults that are around these teenagers? Bethany, I want to ask you, how do people keep a lookout for this, and how do you become suspicious about it?
Yeah, there's all sorts of awesome community trainings in the area, resources online. Just Shared Hope International, the Polaris Project, that have printouts and lists and indicators for people like me who are very visual and like that to look at that. But if you ever see a scenario where your gut is telling you that something is going wrong, whether it seems to be an inappropriate control dynamic between a teenager and an adult, it doesn't seem like they really go together, they might not be related to each other. Homelessness and runaway youth, that is a huge risk factor for being approached by a trafficker. So looking out for youth that seem to be in vulnerable situations are certainly some of the things. With our teachers, looking for changes in school behavior, looking for changes in school performance. Is a child coming and is just all of a sudden tired all the time? It's not necessarily, I tell people all the time, if you feel like something's wrong, you can call law enforcement in to investigate a scenario. If you see a child standing alone at a gas station, for example, that's not a safe environment for a child to be standing alone selling items. So just call law enforcement in to ask those questions if you're not comfortable. If you see something going wrong in an airport, call TSA in to keep an eye on the scenario. It's not falsely accusing somebody of being a trafficker. It is intervening on behalf of that person who may or may not be a victim, but at least somebody says something. So in the event that they are a victim, there may be some opportunity for intervention. So understanding the risk factors is important, and just being able to look out for scenarios that seem to be unusual. And just to add a little bit to what Sally was talking about with our LGBT youth, they're a hugely vulnerable population because they're disproportionately represented amongst our homeless population, which, like I said, is one of our most vulnerable populations. So it's we don't arrest for prostitution anymore in the state of Florida. We don't arrest minors for prostitution anymore in the state of Florida. But there were studies done prior to that that noted that lesbian, bisexual, or questioning girls were more likely than their heterosexual counterparts to be held for prostitution. So there was some discrimination in there as well. But we are, I believe we're making a ton of progress in this field. Myself, along with the human trafficking director at the Department of Children and Families, Kim Gerber, we have made this an issue that we're trying to focus on in terms of making sure these services are being developed to help our human trafficking population in particular. While there's some amazing organizations serving the LGBTQ community in the state of Florida, making sure that they're partnered up with our service providers that are specifically serving sex trafficking victims in the state of Florida, so that we can make sure that both of those needs are addressed with that population. And like Sally said, there is a safe house opening specifically for transgender females later on this year in the Hillsborough County area. So we are making some great progress in terms of making sure we're training on the specific vulnerabilities of our LGBTQ population, making sure that we separate the LGB from the T in terms of understanding various specified vulnerabilities of those two, the gender identification versus the sexual orientation, the two different vulnerabilities that make them vulnerable to trafficking, just trying to really dig into this and understand how we can better identify this population, but how also we can better serve this population and all the needs that they may have.
Okay, well, getting back to intervening when you're suspicious, I wanted to talk to Sally and Lowell. So we mentioned, you know, if you see something suspicious from far away, then you go ahead and report it. But if you're involved, if you're the mom or the dad or the aunt or the uncle, how do you go – that you're kind of on thin ice there with a girl who's being controlled with someone she thinks loves her and cares about her. So what is your advice to people who are more closely associated? Do they go to the – person that may be being exploited, or do they go to the guy, or do they go straight to police? How is it suggested to handle that?
Well, in the case of a family unit that has noticing their daughter's grades is slipping in school when she used to make decent grades or halfway decent grades, all of a sudden they're plunging. She starts dressing more sexually oriented. She turns up with jewelry or purses or gifts that you can't identify where those came from. She's missing at large segments of time. She may be lying and saying she's at a girlfriend's or at the library or somewhere else. But I think that parents need to really check with other parents and identify where their child is at in this day and age so that they don't slip between the cracks. And I think as far as seeing more tattoos appear on them, there's all kinds of subtle changes that go on with that child, but it's always progressive. They become less tolerant of staying under parental rules, so they become argumentative. They become hostile, and you'll see that. And
well, that's the thing. Once a parent says something, you don't want to push her right into that trafficker's arms.
Right, right. And I think the first thing to do is open up dialogue, to take your daughter out once a week and be able to talk to her without trying to push her toward the topic or the venue. Share your time with her, and then you build that bridge to being able to communicate. That's the single most significant thing that parents can do, is to build that communication bridge to make it safe just to be together, just to bond together and
because
to talk.
They're fearful and feel guilty.
That's right. So going after questions rather than just listening to what's going on in her life, that's going to push that information down further and not bring it forward.
You know, I'm very big on prevention. We get the girls after they're rescued. So now we work in rehabilitating them. But if I were a parent in that situation, before it even starts, don't let your kids take their computers into their bedroom. Always be able to see it. Don't let them take their cell phones into their bedroom. Personally, I think at all, but certainly at night, depending on the age. Don't let your kid get a cell phone at too young an age. And start the dialogue right now. Don't let them go with friends to the shopping center, because where do the traffickers go? They go to where the kids are.
So wherever kids congregate.
Beach, same thing. So don't let your kids just go to the beach if they're 12, 13, 14, thinking that three of them together is safe. It isn't.
Yeah. Safety in groups doesn't work. It seems like that's the way they're more easily being picked off.
That's right.
Yeah. If I may add, just to put a quick disclaimer out there, because you did mention potentially intervening in terms of actually talking to the trafficker, I would be really careful. I would caution, even if it's a family unit and you've met that trafficker, or you're noticing that this is a dangerous relationship, I'd be really careful about approaching that trafficker, because there could always be unintended consequences behind the scene.
Or like the girl who faced the ramifications, maybe?
Right.
Yeah.
I agree totally with that. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that out, because even if you're in a shopping center and you identify a stranger maybe manhandling a young girl, you don't want to approach them. The first thing you want to do is call law enforcement in your local community and reach out and say, I'm seeing something here that doesn't look safe. And I don't even have to give my name, but I can identify where they're located.
Well, that's kind of hard to resist the urge to step in on those things, though.
I would also add that law enforcement probably sees more victims than anyone else. But second to that is the healthcare industry. And, you know, we've trained at Lee Memorial Health Systems and other venues. They see them, because if the child or the adult gets hurt, they have to go to a hospital. They have to go get health care. And they need to be able to see and recognize. We've had this situation where we trained and we got a call from the emergency room, say, what do we do? And we said, let's call the sheriff. And they went over there and they rescued a victim.
Now, you guys train people how to handle safe houses. What do people have to do? What kind of requirements are there for safe houses in Florida?
Well, if you, our recommendation is they become licensed by Department of Children and Families. So to become licensed by DCF, there's a lot of legalities and laws that you need to adhere to, which is good. So you have a choice to not become licensed, but We always recommend licensing because you have the accountability, you're working as partners, you really need a lot of collaboration to help a young child that has been brainwashed, that has been put into a post-traumatic stress disorder phase in their life. And I think that DCF does a good job of providing people that will help the safe houses, will help the people that are ministering to the kids and working with the kids, and they have a high scrutiny over these children. So, yes, we always want more, and yes, maybe it's not enough, but in our case, they're working really well with the girls that we received and helping us. Also, there's the judicial phase where we will help prepare a girl for their victim's impact statement and walk with her into the state court or the federal court, whosoever the prosecutor is. And we help them become good witnesses to identify the perpetrator.
Well, I wanted to talk a little about prosecutions when it comes to human trafficking, but I wanted to play like a quick little interview that we had with the Collier County Sheriff's Detective, mm-hmm. Andy Hinchesmore. He worked on human trafficking cases for 6 years, and he said that while things have gotten better in so far as making the arrest, there are still some concerns regarding that. So let's take a listen to that.
A lot of times you'll see these low sentence cases, and it didn't so much have to do with the evidence that you had or anything else. Sometimes the victim will accept the terms of a plea just because she doesn't want to relive it and have to testify sitting there in front of the guy that, you know, was trafficking her. So since the law went into effect, the human trafficking statute, I'm seeing increases in the sentences that are getting issued in these cases.
So, Bethany, I wanted to ask you, how are we doing as far as sentencing in these cases?
Really good successes in the state of Florida. We've actually even had two customers charged with human trafficking, and the mandatory minimum is 10 years in that case, and you can get a max of life in prison. We've actually even had two customers, and it is still really hard. Those issues still exist. Jury pools, they're not necessarily familiar with the topic, and this is a very nuanced, very complex topic. And so that may be one hesitation in going after the actual charge of human trafficking versus sex with a minor or a racketeering act, RICO charge, or various other charges that traffickers may be charged with. But we are making a lot of progress. We've had traffickers, there was a couple in the Central Florida area, 33 years. There was a young man down in the Keys that got over 30 years. So we are seeing some pretty hefty sentences for traffickers. And, of course, we try to be really victim-centered. I know law enforcement, state attorney's office, and the statewide prosecutors try to be victim-centered when working with this population, which may mean that ultimately that victim will never want to testify in court, but in spite of that, we're still getting some pretty good sentences. And whenever possible, of course, we encourage the victim to testify if they're ready and willing and they want to be a part of that process. So I think that we're actually seen some great successes in the terms of prosecution.
Yeah, we're doing well there. And but Sally and Lowell, you were vigorously nodding
yeah,
your heads when
well,
you said that it's tough for those girls to get up on that.
It is very hard from the victim's standpoint, is that you're re-traumatizing them living through that over again. However, we have been successful. We've gotten one perpetrator 100 years in prison through the FBI venue, through federal court. We've gotten one 40 years in prison, one 15 years in prison, and last week, one 20 years in prison.
So you follow these girls all the way through?
We follow them all the way through. We help prepare them, and that's part of the rehabilitation venue. I mean, it's good for them if they can come to the place where they can say this was not okay, that I was victimized and it wasn't okay. That's a healthy point, but it takes a long time to get a child to that point.
Yeah.
So we try to protect the child, maybe keep them out of the courtroom if possible, do the depositions locally so that it can be carried into court.
I would add that when we first started in 2008, it was mostly federal prosecutions. And sometimes we get a state attorney that would call us because it was new territory for them. Now, all of a sudden, there's all these state prosecutions. So it's really wonderful that Florida has really stepped up, and we're seeing many, many more prosecutions now.
All right. Well, we have to leave it there for today. I want to thank our guests, Bethany Jalouf with the Department of Juvenile Justice and Lowell and Sally Sinitz with the Wings of Shelter International in Southwest Florida. Thanks for speaking with us today about this tough issue. And if anybody would like more information about it, we will have links on our website, wgcunews.org. Coming up, a local bluesman heads to Memphis to represent our region in the 2017 International Blues Challenge. We'll hear from him next.